Shrink Wrap Radio Number 9, October 14, 2005. Interview with Dr. Susan Stewart on positive images of aging. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio. This is David Van Nuys, a.k.a. Dr. Dave, and this is the psychology podcast in which I interview interesting, fascinating people from all around the world of psychology. Today's interview is with Dr. Susan Stewart, who has been a longtime friend and who is working on a book having to do with positive images of aging. I think you'll find this a fascinating interview. I know I did. So, without any further ado, let's jump right into it. Well, I wish you all could be where I am right now, because I'm in Dr. Susan Stewart's little cottage out at Dillon Beach. And looking through the picture window here, we can see the sun sparkling on the ocean, and in the distance we can hear the surf. So let's get right into our interview. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David.
And if I recall correctly, you originally trained to be a nurse. So how did you find your way into psychology?
Okay, nursing. I was very young, and I lost my dad and my two best friends in my second year of training, and also lost my faith in medicine. Mm. And the part I'd most loved about nursing anyway was the people contact, so that was seemed like a natural place to go to study people.
Yeah, to study people. So in terms of your academic career, kind of what was the sequence?
The sequence was junior college, nurses school, nurses training, Sonoma State in psychology, and I got my MA there as well, and then went to the California School of Professional Psychology in the East Bay, got my doctorate in clinical psych.
Okay, clinical psych. So you practiced as a psychotherapist for a while, but I know that you moved away from that. What caused you to move away from psychotherapy?
Okay, well, at that point in my life, in my 30s, I was teaching and doing a therapy practice and also working as a market researcher sometimes and raising two boys.
So you had your hands really full.
More than full.
Yeah.
And I really wanted one job. So, and I think I'm a better teacher than I was therapist.
Okay, that's fair. That's honest.
Yeah, I went for where I felt the most, I was making the most difference in the world.
And I know you by reputation and experience as a teacher, and I know that you're very strong in that area. How would you describe to people your particular brand of psychology? For example, which authors or theorists have had the biggest impact on you as a psychologist?
I would say Carl Jung, by far the most. Second would be Carl Rogers. I guess I like Carl's.
Yeah.
So the whole depth psychology, the exploration of the unconscious, dreams, mythology, all of that has just spoken to me before I knew of Jung. And Carl Rogers' ideas of people having their own answers inside, respect for human beings and their differences, and the kind of positive, affirming spin he had on people, I think have been very influential for me.
Right, and even as I look around your cottage here, I'm aware of various crafts and art objects, and I know that you've had a long involvement with making things with your hands, crafts kinds of activities. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that, you know, as a psychologist?
Well, I think Jung, at least for me, was the first person I saw talking about how what comes out of the comes out of our hands is an expression of the unconscious. So I've been involved with these kind of things forever and teach them in as many of my classes as they fit. So I see the body as a vehicle, like dreams, for contacting what we don't quite know we know. Mm-hmm. So collage, very simple. You don't have to be an artist, because I don't know how to draw myself, but collage or piecework or P-I-E-C-E.
Yeah.
Piecing together things.
Right. For example, you've made quilts.
Yes.
I know for years you were making quilts.
Right. That had symbols in them that represented themes in my life or images from dreams or those kind of things.
Okay. I know that recently you've been focusing on the second half of life. What is it that's called you to do this?
I think the first impetus was someone called me a crone.
Uh-oh, is that a bad word?
It's a very bad word. It was meant as a compliment, but I didn't really know what a crone was. I just knew it sounded old, and I was like 52 at the time, and I really didn't like it. And then I had a couple other experiences of people telling me I was about to become one because I was about to be 56, and it was that was in the Celtic tradition, which I love a lot. And finally, I read a fairy tale, an obscure one, about a triple-headed serpent and a male hero lopping off the third head of the snake. And the author was talking about the serpent often representing the goddess, and the third head being the crone head, or the old woman in the trinity of the goddess. And I'd never been very interested in the goddess, but I'm really into underdogs, and when it talked about that getting lopped off. So I had like those three experiences within a short period of time and started doing some reading. So obviously I was becoming an older woman. But those three events really, and then I've had some dreams since that have really given me a sense that this is something I need to be looking into for myself and for other people. Because I think even though our attitudes toward aging have changed and gotten more positive, there's still a lot of negative imagery around about that. And most women and men that I know are not looking forward to getting older.
Right. So there's still a lot of work to do in that area. Mm-hmm. And I know that when you first heard that word crone, it had a negative impact on you. Mm-hmm. You've been working to change that, the spin that's on crone, and you've been doing reading and research that suggests perhaps a different spin. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I found some other authors at this point who've been also looking at this. For example, Jean Bolan, who wrote Goddesses in Older Women, talks about that. And then Marion Woodman, who's also a Jungian, she and Patricia Monahan, who's a feminist scholar, are both looking at the meaning of the word crone. So early, when someone had called me, when I looked it up in the dictionary, oh my God, a withered, witch-like old woman. And I thought, well, no wonder we don't like this. And the origin was claimed to be the French for carrion, or rotting flesh.
Oh, great.
Wonderful, huh? But then Monahan and Woodman both are challenging that, and they're saying that crone comes from the Latin corone, which means crown, and that becoming a crone is about finally wearing the crown of sovereignty in one's own life. And it's, to me, those two visions of, you know, rotting flesh and she who wears the crown, I think are both out there in terms of what it means to be an older woman.
Yeah, great. And I know that in the process you've been studying myths from around the world, fairy tales, you've been collecting pictures. Mm-hmm. What is it that the myths and the fairy tales tell us about the crone and this second part of life?
Mm. She's a wonderful character in stories. She's things you might expect, like wise. She's also, in many stories, quite ageless, sometimes sexually active, actually described as beautiful in a few tales, the lines in her face. She's the necessary fierceness, that witch-like aspect, I think more of as the fierceness that is sometimes needed in a situation. So the crone is sometimes that. She's also very compassionate and loving and selfless. And I don't mean codependent, selfless, giving to get. I mean able to put her own agenda and ego aside and do what is needed by the bigger picture. So the picture that came through these stories of the old woman is she is a creature of incredible paradox. Fierce one moment, compassionate the other, solitary one moment, embedded in writing a situation in the next. She has a fabulous sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And one of the really exciting things that I've stumbled onto lately in the course of writing an academic paper on this, that a lot of the current research in gerontology, psychology, development, medicine, etc., is emphasizing positive possibilities as we age. So the qualities that I was finding in the myths and folk tales are the same characteristics that the literature is writing about, like the capacity for self-transcendence and what the psychologists call emotional mastery, which is a tendency to no longer project and blame others, be able to find contentment regardless of circumstance, being more comfortable in your own skin. Those are part of what research is now also saying is characteristic of the old woman. So I just love when things come together, especially really old stories and very contemporary research, you know, art and science and story. And anyway.
Yeah, that's really fascinating that these different threads are coming together.
Yeah.
And I have to say, my own experience confirms what you're saying in a sort of prosaic way, that I find that the women I know, the mature women, as a male, I can't get away with the stuff that I could get away with when they were younger.
It's true.
Yeah,
it's
they don't. You can't pull the wool over their eyes anymore.
No, we're too wily.
Yeah. Okay. Now I know you're working on a book about this too.
I am.
And what's the title? Do you know the title yet? And can you tell us something about the book?
Sure. The title has changed a couple times. The current title is Aging with Grace and Zest.
I like that.
Thank you. And the subtitle is Inspiring Stories of the Grandmother Crone. And the title, if it remains this way, I really love all the paradoxes that the crone holds. And I think the main message I've gotten about aging as I've been writing and dreaming and reading about this is that aging is on the one hand an experience of coming more into who we really are, which implies a lot of zest, retaining passion and energy. But the other thing, I think, is learning how to die. And I don't mean necessarily the capital D death, but little ways in which our earlier version of who we thought we were undergoes a lot of revision if we let it.
This reminds me of the Buddhist idea of letting go.
Yes, and also Jung's idea of needing, starting at midlife particularly, to really confront what he called the shadow or the other side of the self. So you were mentioning the women who used to be more sweet and now don't let you get away with things.
Right.
So Jung talked a lot about whatever it is we've been, if we listen to our dreams and we look at our life and we listen to other people, we start to see that we are not only, say, selfless and giving, but we're also strong and assertive. And so whatever the imbalances have been or the attachments have been, it's a time, I think, to look at and incorporate the other side, which I think is why the crone has so many facets, because she's been doing this homework. Maybe not consciously, but that idea of allowing all that we are to be developed and therefore at our disposal to use as needed.
Yeah. I guess another way of saying what I was trying to say before is I really see women coming into their power. I know that's a widely used phrase, but it really makes sense. I see women coming into their power as they age. Contrasting that with my experience, my reading in the men's movement and so on, too often men seem to collapse, having been maybe having experienced their power earlier in their lives, but often they collapse into depression and a sense of disempowerment.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to say about that?
A couple things, one of the things that researchers have found, this is a sort of a worldwide phenomenon, is that starting as the raising of children ebbs out of our lives, men tend to become more emotionally oriented, more relational. They become kind of like sweet grandpas. Whereas women, if they've particularly if they've played that nurturing role, maybe to the detriment of their autonomy, start to come into their own power. So that's a fairly common observation worldwide. And I don't see what happens to men as collapsing.
Okay.
I see it as they are incorporating another side that is less valued by the culture, which is the emotional and the relational. And if you've been a top dog, and if you've bought the idea that you are what you earn, and you're not supposed to show weakness, which means emotion, then I think it can be a rough transition, just as a lot of women struggle with losing, quote, our looks, mm-hmm. no longer yeah. being able to get through life on being cute and attracting
right.
supporters, right. basically. I think the transition can be hard for either gender, but I think it's worth going through the death, whatever the little deaths are.
Yeah, what I like about you is you're always equal gender.
Yes.
You're very understanding of both genders, well, and you stand for that, and I really like that.
I think it's from a story I was read as a kid.
Really?
Yeah, by my parents. It was about a couple that were bickering with each other constantly about who was working harder. And so one day they switched lives, and she got to see how hard he worked in the mm-hmm. field and how he sweated for the family, and she got to see how infinitely patient she was with their children and how the jobs were never done that she had to do. And I also grew up without a brother, which I think helped, because I didn't have that comparison in my
uh-huh.
own family.
Uh-huh.
And my parents were remarkably, even though my mother grumbled about men sometimes, I think they were remarkably respectful of each other. And my mother and grandmother, like, loved housework, which I do too. It's kind of like hard
yeah.
to admit. So
yeah.
I have never really felt identified with being a woman as against being a man.
Yes.
I feel like that's a war we don't need. We have too many other wars.
Amen. Amen, sister. We refer to the fact that you've been writing a book.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what's the process of that writing? What's that process been like for you?
It's huge. It's the biggest thing I've ever done, next to raising children, I should add. It's been everything from being incredibly inspired and feeling very supported by women and elders I've met, and elder men too, dreams I've had, other writers in the local community who've been very supportive. And some days it just flows. And then there have been dry periods where I tell myself I don't know anything, and what do you think you are? And I think the process is... I don't think you can write a book like this without embodying it. And I think the ways that I have not known my own value or trusted what I know, which is part of becoming a crone, I've had to really work a lot with myself. So it's been everything from exhilarating to frustrating to almost too much. But I think it's the first time in my life I felt like I must do this, even though part of me just would like to not do it. It's almost like I can't not do it.
Right, right. So it's not just writing a book. It's also a growth process.
Yeah, for me.
And a kind of a cauldron that you're cooking inside of.
Yes, wonderful crone image, the cauldron.
Yeah.
Yes.
So based on your studies and your own personal explorations and experiences, what advice, if any, would you give our listeners as they confront the latter part of their own lives? I know this is kind of putting you on the spot.
Yes. Boy, that's a big question. Well, one thing I'd say is everyone ages differently. The current elders we have are pioneers in this uncharted territory that our grandparents never lived to see. Life expectancy was 45 at the turn of the other century.
Mm-hmm.
So current elders, I think, have a lot to teach us. So I'd say hang out with people older than you are. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of books emerging on the market of, you know, successful aging, productive aging, ageless aging. And so I love seeing those, but I think allowing ourselves to find our own way in mm-hmm. the last half of our life is part of what that's about. Within a community of people, like talking and listening, but there aren't rules that I mean, I could make up a few. I'd say, like, trust the process and learn how to die and enjoy the ride and hang out with cronies. But I don't know that there's any hard and fast rules, because the experience is different. Some of us have some cognitive challenges as we age, or health challenges. Others don't. And the models that we've had, even in gerontology, I think up to fairly recently, of elder people have really been based on medical problems, as if that was the norm. Sort of like looking at adolescence and only looking at kids who get into drug abuse and thinking that's what adolescence is about. So I think we've had a really skewed picture toward the problem end. And it isn't that there aren't challenges, but the elders I've been running into these days, not just in the stories, but ones, you know, in bodies, are incredibly alive and positive. And they already know that this can be the best time of life. Where I've seen the most fear is in young people, I think because of the stereotypes. The mm-hmm. idea of getting old is all wired up with disability and disease and dementia. And it isn't that those never happen, but they aren't necessarily the norm.
Yeah, I think that we all have a sense that we don't live in a culture, unfortunately, that prepares us very well or gives us positive messages about yeah. aging.
Right, I agree.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned books. Are there one or two books that come to mind that you would recommend in case any of our listeners want to follow up on what we've been discussing?
Yeah. For men and women, James Hillman's Force of Character.
Okay.
It's not a very sexy title, but
no.
it's a wonderful book on the virtues of aging from kind of a Jungian perspective. Not aging as not being youthful, but what are the qualities and dimensions of age that are wonderful.
What was that title again?
It's called The Force of Character.
Force of Character.
James Hillman. Terry Apter wrote an interesting book on women at midlife called Secret Paths, about women, how women are navigating that passage. And I guess I think of the second half of life as 50s on, maybe, at this point. And I think they're very connected. And I think the 50s are very different than the 80s, from what I can see.
Mm-hmm.
Another beautiful book on later life is Florida Scott Maxwell's A Measure of My Days. It's kind of a narrative writing. And Mae Sarton's poetry and writing on 80 and other work she's done. And I think Jean Boland's work with Goddesses in Every Woman. And Marion Woodman has written, and she also has a audio series called The Crown of Age that's very inspiring.
Yes, I have that series,
yeah.
and it truly is inspiring.
Yeah. So those are some that just leap to mind that are I've really enjoyed and gotten a lot from.
Well, Susan Stewart, thank you so much for this interview. I've really enjoyed the process.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, consider yourself shrunk and wrapped. Or should I say expanded?
Okay. That's the interview. In my intro, I forgot to mention that Susie is a member of the psychology faculty at Sonoma State University. And I know that you've heard mention of the psychology department at Sonoma State University in several of these podcasts. This is the institution where that I've been associated with for many years, so it's only natural that I would start out close to home because there are many extraordinary individuals there that I want to share with you. But don't despair. Don't think that our focus is going to be terribly narrow. Indeed, I will be networking out across the whole country and indeed to other countries as well, as in fact I've already done. So don't think that you're going to have just a totally parochial point of view here, focusing only on Sonoma State University, as wonderful as that psychology department is. And also I want to mention that Susie is just the first of many women that I plan to interview. I know that the early podcasts were a little heavy on the male side, but that is changing. You might know that in addition to being a psychologist, I'm also a market researcher. And next week I'm going to be in Beverly Hills at a market research conference. And while there, I intend to collar some of my colleagues who are also psychologists and market researchers and to interview them about how they see these two worlds coming together, their take on consumer psychology, etc. On another topic, I was out for my daily walk yesterday, and I was listening to a podcast, one of my favorite podcasts, which is Rob Walch's podcast 411, and I was really surprised and delighted to hear that he played my promo at the end of his show. And that's good news because I think he has a pretty large audience. And speaking of audience, I received a wonderful piece of listener feedback email, which I'd like to share with you. It comes from John Roberts, who writes, "I found your show on a general search on iTunes in the educational category, and I was really happy to find something that dealt with psychology. I'm an undergraduate psychology student at Eastern Kentucky University, and I'm really considering going to grad school, either clinical or school psych master's programs. I'm really excited about your future episodes, and I would have to say that I really enjoy your Freudian psychoanalytic topics. I feel that my undergraduate education has been biased, focusing on behavioral, cognitive, and physiological areas in psychology. Freudian and other modern theories of psychoanalysis are not really covered. My college psychology department basically points out Freud's flaws and does not mention the theories of Carl Jung or Adler or other more recent theorists, which I'm very disappointed in, considering that psychoanalysis is what really drew me to psychology. Like you, I started out in engineering and for various reasons, mainly calculus, switched to psych. I have mentioned your show to many of my fellow classmates and faculty, and I'm sure you will soon have a small fan base in Kentucky. I really enjoyed the Death of Psychology episode. I agree with Trumbull. In fact, I had thought of something similar after a long class in physiological psych. A friend of mine had mentioned how she wanted to study neuroscience, and it hit me that all of human behavior can be described by the chemistry and the physical processes of the brain. Behavior, psychoanalytical, cognitive, and interactionist theories are all just skewed, overt observations of what is really happening. Anyway, good luck with future episodes, and I cannot wait to hear future episodes. Also, I would really appreciate any advice or recommended readings for the topics that you mention." And he signed it, John Roberts. So, John, thank you very much for that feedback. And certainly, there have been some recommended readings mentioned in many of these shows, and sometimes on the show notes you will find them at www.shrinkwrapradio.com. In your email, John, I'm not sure that Carl Jung or Adler could be classified as recent theorists, but I do understand your point that, in fact, many psychology departments around the country are wedded to a behavioral and experimental point of view, and that seems to be the dominant model in psychology. Like you, I've always been interested in alternative approaches and hope to explore many alternative approaches in this series. And I'm hoping that there are other students out there maybe who have similar feelings of that they're getting exposed to a fairly narrow range of what's available in psychology. And I'm hoping that this series will help to address that. And if you have succeeded in getting any of your faculty there to listen to this series, I hope I haven't just offended them. The other point that I want to comment on is your observation that everything really comes down to physiological psychology, that if we understand the underlying brain processes, then maybe that's all the psychology that we would need. And I would like to counter that by saying that we have to watch out for the danger of engaging in what's called reductionism. For example, you could take it a step further and say that the neurological processes in the brain are in fact based on the behavior of atoms, and that the behavior of the atoms are in turn affected by subatomic dynamics. But, you know, no matter how well we understand subatomic dynamics, I doubt that they would ever account for psychological phenomena. Rather, we have to realize that as we study the world, that we're dealing with systems within systems within systems, and depending upon the phenomena that we're trying to study and account for, we need to study it at the appropriate system level. So I'm not sure that While there's much that can be learned by studying the brain and the operation of the nervous system, I don't think it will account for all psychological phenomena. There are some phenomena that just need to be understood at a higher level. I'm not sure I've made this point as clearly as I ideally would like to, but I also don't want to belabor it. I'm also pleased by John's letter because it confirms at least one notion I have about my target audience. Various friends sometimes ask me why I'm doing it and who I intend my audience to be. Well, my reasons for doing it are, one, that I enjoy it, and two, that I see it as something of a public service. When I think about my target audience, certainly I see psychology students as a key segment of that audience. And that's why John's letter is particularly confirming. He's a college psychology major, and he did a search on higher education podcasts, and voila, Shrink Wrap Radio came up. And that's one of my ideal scenarios. However, at the same time, I'm also hopeful that it will appeal to a general audience as well. So I've struggled with the question of whether to list it in directories under education or under talk. Okay, well, that's today's show. Please email your comments to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and please tell all your friends to visit us. We've had close to 3,000 downloads in our first 2 months, so I know you're out there and would love to hear from you. You can leave audio comments on Gizmo Project, which for Shrink Pod, that's the name to leave it for, Gizmo Project being free software that you can download for either the PC or the Mac. The same thing is true for Skype. Our name is Shrink Pod on both Skype and Gizmo Project. Finally, if there are any podcasters listening, let's talk about swapping promos. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave reminding you, it's all in your mind.